Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to reconvene to the public accounts hearing this afternoon with the Department of Health and Community Services and the health authorities. So we've moved to the fifth heading, personal care home regulations, and we'll start the process with any questions, starting with Mr. Bragg.
Okay, we're all ready. Hope we had a great lunch. Nice light lunch. So I'm just wondering, where are we with the operating standards for personal care homes? Has there been any movement on that? Is there any listing or?
Okay. If I may, just for a second, and get them to answer your direct question. In the Auditor General's report, he provided 16 recommendations, two specific to our department, six targeted to the regional health authorities, and eight to the government service centers or service NL. Just wanted to let you know, of the eight recommendations that between the department and the RHAs are dealing with, six have been fully implemented and two are partially implemented. So with respect then to your question on the standards, right now we have a draft of the standards that are complete. We are currently reviewing those in the department, and we expect to have those signed off and out to the system this fall.
Okay. And we talked about nutrition earlier this morning, not in personal care homes, but is that being looked at too, or are we just looking at the overall appearance and the qualifications of the employees?
No, it would be the full
gamut of everything,
yes.
Right? So,
yep.
Okay. So when that's available, I'm assuming there'll be reports online?
We're going to move in that direction,
yes.
And the government overall is moving there. So we have yet to develop our plan as to what and when we'll be putting online, but most of these will be. But I can't tell you when.
So are you guys aware of any right now that are probably operating at a level that would be considered inferior?
Well, what I can say is. There's certainly one home that is under a sort of a conditional license, and that we are working with that operator at present.
Okay, thank you. Mm. All right, I'll move on.
You good?
Yep.
Okay, Mr. Pitt.
Thank you very much. Personal care homes, yeah, well, ironically, I have 13 in my district.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's right. So, But if you guess to belabor it, to go back, a lot of what we talked about this morning with the nutrition, I guess really bed management too, acute care beds, it all kind of goes hand in hand with our personal care homes because they're part of the bigger system of our long-term care strategy, I guess, to various levels. But I guess the question I got is, there's varying level of care, you know. There's various levels of care. Out of the 13 in my district, each one of them could be rated on a different level. But yet, under the Regional Health Authority, under Eastern Health, they're all considered to be, take level one or level two, you know, they're all rated for whatever, for various residents. But if you could, I guess what I'm questioning is, what levels of what quality assurance mechanisms do the departments or the RHAs have in place to make sure that you're getting? So if you're going in a home that's providing level one care, they should all be relatively of the same standard. And I hate to say it, but unfortunately they're not. I know you say you have one on conditional license, but like what checks and balances? Who's really policing to make sure you get the proper nutrition, the proper environment, pretty well right across the board, right? Because there is a distinct difference in the level of care, the level of, accommodations, the level of service provided to various, depends on which home you go in.
Yes, and particularly in your district in Conception Bay South with the community care homes that really came out of the Waterford program, and so they're required, and there are certain standards that have been set for them, and we fund them accordingly. Each of the RHAs then have the program and a director or managers that are responsible with any of their professional staff, whether it's the social workers that would visit the nurse, community nurse, that if there are issues and deficiencies, what have you, that they are to report those and as part of their monitoring. But we know there are weaknesses in our system. So part of the review we're doing now and developing the standards, again, also developing a monitoring framework, is that we move to increase the quality. In terms of the care requirements, they are assessed by the whether it's the social worker or nurse as to the required care and a home's ability to provide that care and manage the resident. When and what we are actually doing in the personal care home is we, to your sort of initial comment, they are a significant player in the long-term care sector or the community and long-term care sector. We are looking to see where we can expand how they deliver service. Can they take patients who may have a higher level of need but can be accommodated in a personal care home? And we have an enhanced, so we've just put, over the past year or so, have had an enhanced subsidy to allow that. And at the same time, we are supporting the personal care homes for those to provide them with more resources for those residents who now need to transition into long-term care. They've been assessed to move, but if in the case where there isn't a bed, we recognize that we also had to provide more resources to that personal care home to allow them to take care of that resident while we're waiting. We have a standing committee in place with the personal care home operators, and we work with them. There's been some challenges within that sector, and we're trying to work through the issues with them.
Okay. I'll move, Ms. Parsons. Mm-hmm. Moving on to personal.
Okay. I can come back here.
Ms. Rogers.
Yes. Somebody that I'm working with insisted that I bring the report of the Commission of Inquiry into the Chafe's Nursing Home Fire, December 26, 1976. Mm. And we all know what a tragedy that was, and that was also because of safety standards. Yep. And how very, very difficult that is. And in that inquiry, there was a quote, "We have placed our trust in government to ensure that these homes are controlled and supervised so that there is an acceptable standard of safety and care. And it would appear from the evidence that has come to light during this inquiry that this trust has been somewhat misplaced." And I'm sure that we have really learned from that tragedy. But there also are some, you know, that was 40 years ago, but we still have some issues that arise because of standards and whether they're adhered to or enforced, and how is that. And again, I really understand and can appreciate, although my knowledge is somewhat limited, on the extreme the growing need for different kinds of care for whether it's seniors or people with disabilities, and how do we meet those in this particular economic climate, and also with our shifting demographics. So the Auditor General recommended a comprehensive review of personal care home operating standards and the Regional Health Authority monitoring standards every 2 years. So the department's response is that these items are almost complete, these
yes.
two items. So can we, when will you expect them to be complete? I'm not sure if you answered that in the previous.
Yes, Ms. Rogers, we intend to have those released this fall.
So will we be able to get, will those be public
oh,
documents?
Yes.
Okay, great. And so we'll be able to get copies of those. The issue of inspections of our personal care homes, we now release the results of inspections in food establishments.
Yes.
Will the department make public results of all inspections of personal care homes?
That's as part of our, with the standards and putting on a monitoring framework, that's our intention to do that.
Okay.
We have to coordinate what we do with the government service centers because they do the physical fire life safety monitoring and reporting. But that's the direction we intend to go.
Do you see any possible objections to that, any pushback at all? Is there anything that would you think would prevent that from happening?
Not that we're seeing. I mean, there may be somebody in the industry that may not be as welcoming of that, but we are consulting, obviously, with the sector, and but we, as a policy direction, we are moving in that, moving towards that public reporting.
Great. And the Auditor General also recommended that all four RHAs implement, I don't want to say surprise inspections, but unannounced inspections. And the department's response was that Eastern Health will continue to do so. So why not? Will all the other regional health authorities do that as well?
I think we're going to have more conversations with them on the specifics of that and how that is done. But putting that aside for the moment, each of the RHAs have staff visiting in those homes constantly, regularly, announced, unannounced, and either to, because it's part of their, it's community health nurse going in to do their visit with their patients and other social workers, what have you. What we want to do is that they will have a formal reporting. Anytime they go in for whatever reason, there is a report and recorded, and they will, and it's part of their normal activities, if they notice anything that should be brought to the attention of their managers or director, then that will then be recorded. So that, I think, will go a long way in addressing that. Part of that is also, I think, looking at from a risk point of view, which homes are probably looking at having challenges, whether around care issues or food issues or life safety issues, and making sure we won't visit them and monitor them more closely, right, and obviously more unannounced. So in the case I mentioned that we are looking at addressing right now, we are doing regularly unannounced, inspections to make sure that they are meeting the terms of those conditions.
Yet those situations, whether it be an OT or a nurse or whatever, they have a specific task when they go in, so they wouldn't be looking at a global thing.
No, but they will have a sort of a template, then they can report against that they, when they're there, yes, they're there for their regular business, and, oh, by the way, and this is what else we've noted.
But you'll also be looking at doing the unannounced, more global inspections.
Yes.
Great.
Ms. Rogers.
Thank you.
To Mr. King. Thank you.
Hey, I haven't got a whole lot on this one, actually. It seems to be pretty much up to date. There's a few that are partially implemented and one not implemented, and that goes back to January of this year. Can you give me an update on those? I think it would be the first 3, 5, and 6 on the first
so
page.
If I can just quickly, in recommendations 1 and 2 are partially implemented in terms of the operating standards will be out this fall. Reporting results to the public, we are working actively on that and may begin reporting as early as in the next week or two. Okay. So that's, we're focused on that for the data we have. Recommendations 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 are implemented.
Okay. So just one more question, and a lot of this has been fully implemented over the last 2 years. So for the fully implemented recommendations from the health authorities, are you finding a noticeable difference in the improvement of following the regulations?
I think.
Or have you had an opportunity to do the follow-up?
I think it's the standards when they were written and then where we were. So I think what would happen is we sort of put the standards there and we followed them, but we weren't monitoring against them as closely as we should. I don't think there was any issue in when we talked to the RHAs and how we do that. Again, the staff and the directors and managers are constantly meeting with the operators, visiting those things. So there was a process in place to do that. Now we've formalized that to make sure that is done on a regular basis according to the standards, and then we now can report out with more confidence.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Pitt?
No, I'm good.
Mr. Finn?
Just curious on the reporting of the results, which you said you're partially through. It says the department will begin to posting, this is a recommendation number two, the license status. Hmm. Are you going to get into any more specifics around that? I guess back to Jerry's point, like what information other than just like a license has been like?
Yeah, so we'll start with that, and then once we have the standards done and our monitoring framework in place, then we'll provide more comprehensive reports on are they meeting those standards and where they're deficient, and then that will allow you to interpret why the license was fully fully met or conditional.
Right. I just asked because some of them were referring to fire life safety.
Yes.
And some of those nuances. So
yep.
It's one thing, I guess, to log online and see that, you know, personal care home ABC is licensed, but it's another thing to know that it's licensed, yet there was a noncompliance
right.
with
and
this,
so
this,
that's
or that.
What, you know, so that's where we want to get.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Excellent. Okay, that's all. It looks like great progress on all those fronts.
Thank you. Ms. Rogers?
There where John left off, John. Mm-hmm. The Auditor General recommends that three of the RHAs, Eastern Central and Labrador, Granville, should only license personal care homes when they comply with the personal care home operational standards.
Yeah.
That's self-evident.
Yep.
Recommendation. So why do you think there were personal care homes licensed when they did not comply? Like, what was the reasoning? How
I we've had that discussion internally from time to time. When an operator, whether it's in this case a personal care home or whether it's an ambulance operator or what have you, when they are deviating from the accepted standard, then we look at the context in which that is happening. So if it's a case of, yeah, there's a fire extinguisher not working, that's one thing.
Yes.
If there is no sprinkler system working, that's a different issue. But then you get into is there a plan in place to address that is satisfactory and poses no risk to the resident? And then thirdly is we then have to have a contingency. In any event, can we move the residents? So in some cases, there is my term here, not the department's term, sort of a bit of a compromise to be worked out, because in some cases there is no option to relocate the residents. So we have to work with the operator, and in those cases, then we're in doing regular monitoring and inspections and follow-up so that the risk is minimized, not obviously eliminated, until the deficiency is addressed. So it's not ideal from our perspective, but it's the reality in which, you know, I guess our system has to operate.
I can't remember now going through the documents. Are there still existing personal care homes that do have some non-compliance?
Yes.
And do we know what they are? Is it possible to get that information?
We have those that would, you know, and I said there's, you know, one that's sort of very, very current that we're currently working here in the eastern region, but that is available, yes.
So we can get a copies of
yes.
that. Okay, great. Thank you very much. So the Auditor General again recommended that Eastern Health Central, Western RHAs ensure that personal care home staff meet the minimum hiring requirements as required. I think you spoke
yes.
a little bit to this. So this report now is 2 years old.
Hmm.
So the department's response is that Eastern Health is doing this. What about the other RHAs and how?
Yeah,
how
so we're obviously in having conversations with each of those, and they're fully apprised of this. Two things here. One is in terms of which sort of requirement they need to meet. So we were, as an example, so if you're hiring a new employee, if they have been tested for tuberculosis, now if you need, you know, yes, and we do that. But if their need for that individual is now on a Friday and they haven't got that test because it's scheduled for next week, could or should we hire that person? I think the answer is I think we will. We'll take that risk as long as there's follow-up. Do they have first aid, those things? So I was looking at each of those criteria and saying, well, what is the risk in the event of? But the goal is obviously to not only meet those minimum requirements, but to increase those, particularly as the residents are getting, you know, they're older now, they're frailer, and they're having a more complex health condition. So we know we need to increase that that issue. The reality we're facing in some areas, not all, is staffing shortage, you know, availability of.
Yeah.
And so there, and many times the operators are left scrambling to find anybody, dare I say, to fill in. And that's where we've got to be careful, because we may be compromising yet on the wrong thing. So mm-hmm. we are working with those operators for them to have some contingencies as to, you know, their recruitment plans. But if it comes to a point they can't, then that's another conversation that needs to take place, because at the end of the day, it's the resident that needs to, their needs have to be fully addressed. And if the operator cannot do that in a sustained way, then the license would have to, you know, would have to be removed. There's no two mm-hmm. ways about that.
And I imagine as well, if as you spoke earlier, that the personal care homes that you're looking at,
yep.
having people with higher level
yep.
of needs
mm.
and needing higher yep. level of care. So, and I was going to ask you about that. I imagine that
yep.
staffing is a challenge, and I would imagine it's because of demographics,
yep.
but it's also because of level of pay.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and that will be you know, a factor, and we're cognizant of that. If that, at the end of the day, is the issue, then we obviously have those conversations, and we continue to adjust based on you know, provincial need, wage levels, and local wage as needed in these programs. So we constantly adjust around home support and in any of those community-based programs. Again, it's been less an issue of pay
mm-hmm.
as just simple availability of individuals that are willing to do this work. It's difficult
yeah.
and hard work. There's no doubt about that.
And so what's being done to try and address that?
Because
it is a growing problem,
yes.
isn't it?
And we've, again, the operators in are ultimately responsible for the recruitment. So we work with them. We're working, obviously, with the private and public colleges to make sure there's those that are trained to move in this work, and we do a lot of work in our HR, human resource planning in the health system, so we know where the needs are, where the capacity is in the training system to meet that. We are making sure we have sufficient subsidies provided that allows the operator to hire
mm-hmm.
appropriately and at the appropriate wage levels. So it is within health, and there's one or two other areas where the staffing is going to be a bit of a problem, and there's no immediate fix for some of these operators.
It's, Did you just finish this?
Do you have any other questions?
I'm thinking about the personal care home that caught fire and burned, I think, right to the ground last year in Central.
Did we
learn anything from that? Because I'm thinking, like, emergency plans as a... and where to put all the residents.
Yes.
Most of them have closed up their houses, or the family has sold their house.
Yep.
Like, what would be the contingency plan there?
There are, you know, contingency plans that each operator would have. Then it's, in the short term, obviously, is there an adjacent home or facility that back into a hospital, nursing home, or a related community facility? Obviously, talking to the family for those that can return home for a short period of time. In this case, it worked out well. The community came together, the adjacent communities, and we were able to literally that evening and into the next morning have everybody located. And obviously, this is a long-term thing. It's the only home on the Bay Burke Peninsula. So we were able to place everybody for a longer term. The challenge then for those is there's no
necessarily immediately that they're going to go back within a month or even a year. This is, we're not sure yet. I believe the operator may be rebuilding, but I don't know. So the lesson learned is we just build on that. Each of our health authorities have fairly good emergency planning systems in place that we rely on. We monitor those, and if there's a resource shortage, dollars, whatever, we'll make that available. But in this case, they were able to accomplish and accommodate all of that within the region in literally less than 24 hours.
Okay, thank you. One other quick question: like capacity for these buildings, are they at full capacity? Like for a guest, like
in terms of no, it varies across the region.
60%
vacancy. And so I was going to say that. So around 16, according to Denise's numbers here, vacancies. Sorry, within that. So it varies by region. Central, the vacancy is a bit higher.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. No more questions for me, sir.
Mr. Pitt, you good? Ms. Parsons?
I think we've covered everything, but I had concerns for you.
Yes, back to the staffing issue. I was in conversation with someone from Labor who was saying that the majority of people providing home care or this type of personal care are women in their 50s and some middle to late 50s. And that soon they won't be working and doing this kind of work. So it really is.
Yeah, no, it's how to make this a more attractive opportunity for young people. But that's true for this and home support. Some of the home care agencies would find, certainly in the more rural areas of the province, and trying to meet the need because our seniors are staying in place, the young people are moving out.
Yeah.
So that's going to be an issue that we will have for some time to come. And we, as I said, we are working with the operators and the trainers to make sure, to the degree possible, to have people in place. So we do, it's like physicians in rural areas, we do have times when there's a shortage. We work diligently trying to find a solution with the community. So far, we've been able to do that, but it's when we project out again. And it is trying to make sure we can support people in the rural communities. It's not easy.
This is not one that can be solved by automation.
No, that's right.
Okay. The Auditor General did identify that 16 critical fire and life safety deficiencies identified in 7 of the 30 personal care homes reviewed, yet the Auditor General could not verify if these critical issues were dealt with quickly. Several of the same issues were identified in previous year's inspection as well. So what's been done since this report to ensure that this is not the case, that serious issues are dealt with properly and to be able to verify that properly, quickly?
Mr. Roger, because it's with the government service centers and Service NL, I don't know if I can answer that to the degree that you would like. We have checked with them prior to coming here today.
Yes.
That we've been informed that those recommendations have been fully implemented by them.
Okay. Okay, thank you. One of the issues the interesting letter to the editor in the Telegram that was August 2016 from a person who had personal experience with personal health care homes and was critical of many of the same problems identified by the Auditor General. And one of the issues was that the inspection process for relicensing a personal care home did not include questioning the residents or their families regarding their satisfaction with the quality of care.
And I think one of the things we will be doing on a go-forward basis is, as throughout all our healthcare services, is doing more client, resident, family satisfaction surveys.
Okay.
Because that's one of the common standards for around quality, and that's recognized. But so that's on our will be in our plan going forward.
So that we'll see that a regular course of action.
Yep.
Great. Thank you. And also, has there any consideration being given? So if you are, in fact, doing inspections, that if inspections are being done, to include resident and family input in the actual inspection?
I don't think, you know, now I don't know if the previous question and this are connected here.
Yes.
I mean, we will be, in terms of an appropriate survey, would mm-hmm. ask them, you know, their observations or concern issues around are they satisfied with ABC, you know, the physical
right.
condition, life, whatever, however we phrase that. But I don't know two things. For the areas that we're responsible for, I mean, there can be, you know, family councils, whatever, certainly long-term care, that is the case, and their input is certainly requested and encouraged. But in terms of actually participating in, depending if I understand your question correctly, the process of inspections or monitoring, I wouldn't necessarily see that, at least from where we work. I don't want to speak for ServiceNL, but I wouldn't necessarily anticipate that they would be doing
I guess if there's any formalized inspections of any aspect to actively then, not that they would do that, but to actively reach out to residents or families as part of that process.
But I think the important part here is whatever they find collectively, that there is a public report that the residents, particularly and their families, are fully apprised of the results of those reports. So that if there are obviously issues, or as you are selecting where you want to go, or your family member, then you have that that information.
Okay, but you're also going to survey.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Great. And a complaints process. Is there a formalized complaints process? How does that work?
So again, if there is a complaint process, it would be within the RHA, and then they would record and monitor that. We at the department on occasion would get a complaint directly from a family member or a resident, but usually a family member on their behalf. We would address that through the with the RHA, and the requirement is then that they would follow up with the family and or the operator or both, depending on the nature of the complaint, and then report back to the minister.
Okay, and do you see how the seniors advocate, what kind of role the seniors advocate might have in this area?
Not
just in complaints, but I mean in the whole issue of personal care homes.
I guess our assumption is that, you know, given that we are the department that deals largely with seniors' issues in terms of care and through the full gamut of care issues, that we will have a lot of engagement with the advocate. The advocate's role will be more systematic issues, and these all bubble up at times, and you've got a systematic issue there, or systemic issue, excuse me, that we will be working closely with the citizens' representative from time to time. He's making his reports based on what is happening in the healthcare, and we work, respond to that. And what we find, actually, that's a very useful process because it takes the subjectivity and the out of it, and it deals, you know, it's fact-based, and it's an independent observer and recorder of the facts. And we encourage many residents and families, when they're not satisfied, and they're not satisfied with our answer for what, that we encourage them to go to the citizens' representative office, because then we think they will get a fair hearing, and then it helps us with improving our processes where they need to, and rather than us trying to defend some things that probably are indefensible.
Okay, I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Everybody good? Mr. AG, you're good? Okay, good. Thank you, Mr. Abbott, and your officials. Now we'll move to our last heading under Health and Community Services and Eastern Health.
which is the Road Ambulance Services. And I want to welcome Mr. Wayne Young, who's the regional provincial specialist in this area. So, and you've been sworn in, so it's all official. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Bragg to ask any questions, please.
Okay, thank you. I have a couple of three questions. I guess I'll start off with the training. It seems like the farther you are, and again, this is only, I looked at the map, and this is only eastern, so I'm assuming from Clarenbell East that this report was done. But it's probably reflective for the rest of the province. But it seemed like the farther you are away from the Avalon region, St. John's region, the more lenient you are to the actual training of the ambulance attendants. Is there a reason for that? Is it a job with staffing or?
If I may, just as before I answer the specific question, just to give you an update on the recommendations, the Auditor General provided 12 recommendations, 8 that were specific to our department and 4 specific to Eastern Health. And of those 12, 11 are partially implemented and 1 we have not started implementing. I think the simple answer to the question is one of capacity in each of the health authorities and then within the operator community to take this on. We're, as a department, and certainly in the direction we have from the minister, is that we need to really focus on this aspect of the road ambulance service. We need to engage the training system because there's a capacity issue there. We can only train so many. And I think, Wayne, if I'm correct, if we met exactly what the AG is sort of suggesting or implying, which we agree with, is it would probably take us 7 years or something to get where we need to go. And we know that's not sustainable in terms of what we need to achieve here. So we are looking at some self-regulation for paramedicine so that they can up their game. We need to provide more training capacity within the province. And then at a certain point, hopefully sooner than later, that with the operators, then in terms of our service level agreements with them, that they will have to meet a higher level of training before we will fund them. Now, that's, again, easy to say, because that means a lot of change is going to happen, and the operators are going to have to step up their game as well.
So in the community groups, would that be volunteers?
Volunteers on that. So if you're in the ambulance, if you're paid or volunteer, you're going to have to meet a certain standard. We, relative to other provinces, have a lower level of standard of care. We are providing the emergency service as needed, but the ability then for the attendant to actually provide care is minimized because they are not paramedics. And we need paramedics on all these ambulances if we want to provide the standard of care that people expect and we believe needs to be delivered. So it's a lot of change that has to happen in very short order.
Okay, thank you. And the other question I have is relating to response times, and I guess I'll tie this in with the. And you can. I'm not really familiar with the 911 system. If the Avalon always had it, or was just the Greater St. John's area, but the new 911 system province wide. Does that speed up the ambulance response time, or does it somewhat slow it down?
Well, again, there's a change in what which each region or community is used to. So if you're calling an ambulance, you can call 911, and then St. John's, that's accepted. You could call the hospital directly, or you can call the operator directly. So depending on who you call, when you call. So if you're calling 911, and then they have to, triage that and send it over to the operator. So there's obviously a gap in time, and depending on how sophisticated your system is. So we are learning outside the Greater St. John's area how to do that better, but still not perfect. Our response times then So that once the call is in, then the call, if it's to 911, the 911 to the operator. The operator then, once whoever on dispatch receives the call, within 10 minutes that ambulance is supposed to be leaving for the scene. And that's sort of what we measure, and we have all the statistics on that for each service across the province. Okay. And we monitor that closely.
I was just curious, like, if this, you get complaints where people are used to calling the local number, now they call 911, they call back there, and people are saying, now where I used to wait 10 minutes, I wait 40 minutes.
Yeah.
You're not hearing that, are you?
No, we've heard, you know, examples of that.
Yeah.
And when we do hear that, we do trace, you know, go back to find out who called whom when and try to measure that. And then if there's a problem in that community or region, then we're honing in on that to make sure that the residents know exactly who they should be calling.
If you look at your ambulance system overall, would you rate, like, the best situation anybody should go forward with, like ambulance from the hospital, ambulance from a volunteer group, or from a private company?
Well, I don't know if it in terms of which one it is. Are they meeting the standards that you're setting, and do they have an efficient, high quality dispatch? Do they have good vehicles, and do they have trained paramedics on that vehicle? And that they're the sort of the three sort of elements. If you got that right, then you'll have a good service. So when we, both in terms of the AG report, but also the other work that the department has done in terms of the Fitch report, which has been referenced, they did a comprehensive review of our ambulance service here in the province. They've laid out a series of recommendations that if we follow those according to their recommendations, we will have high-quality ambulance service throughout the province. We are starting the implementation of that report in tandem when looking at these recommendations, because they do go hand in glove. And the first focus for us now is on central dispatch. We have to have all ambulances coming out of basically one system, so we know exactly where all ambulances are, what they're doing, how they're doing it. And right now we're able to monitor where they are, but we're still running, like, you know, multiple services, and we have exclusive areas and things like that. All of that has to change if we want to improve the service.
One final question, Mr. Chair, and that has to do with the condition of the ambulances, the overall condition, except for service. And are there any other checks and balances to make sure the ambulance is up to code?
Well, there are different inspection systems, and one of the things that we have here in this province, we do not have one piece of legislation that covers all aspects of the ambulance service, from the time you're licensed to have it, to monitor the vehicles, to monitor who's on the vehicles. So we are working on drafting legislation, hopefully this fall, if not the next year, to put in house so we can bring all of those pieces together.
Thank you. That's it from you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Pitt.
Thank you very much. On this issue, I guess one broad question I'd ask, is the funding adequate for the road ambulance program? You hear anecdotally, and we've heard over protests,
yep,
complaints. It seems to originate back some policy, but a lot of funding issues.
Mr. Pitt, I don't see it that way, and certainly the department. Again, we are meeting the needs of each of the ambulance services and operators across the province, and we negotiate on that. And we've added significant new dollars over the past under the current agreement. For the hospital-based services, we work with them on their budget needs, but we're also challenging them to be how they can be more efficient, to do things more effectively. So, as an example, we in Western Health last year, and now we're moving into Central Health and hopefully into Eastern Health in the near future, is when we are doing non-medical transports, right? So why do you use the same, you know, the same service and attendance for that service when you're responding to an emergency? They're two completely different services. So they have now moved to change that. So that frees up resources and saves dollars that they can put back into the ambulance program. We have, depending on how you measure this, but at the department, we believe we have an overcapacity of ambulances in this province. We can reduce the number of ambulances and use that money to put it into training and increasing the skill level and obviously payment within the system, and also support having a central dispatch system throughout the province. But that means you know, certain decisions would have to be made as to which ambulances and which communities would have to change. But again, it's the bigger costs are certainly in the urban centers, and their response times are closely examined, and we expect, you know, again, we talked this morning about value for money, to make sure we get that in those services. And from time to time, we do get complaints. There isn't sufficient capacity on a particular hour in a particular day, particularly in the St. John's area, but they have systems in place to address that, and they can call on the regional fire department and others and other ambulances to support them if need be. So it's really, really measuring the risk at any point in time. But as the population changes and the communities change, we got to respond with the appropriate ambulance service.
Okay. Yeah, and I had another question. It was on medical transport, so you answered. You went 2-for-1 on that.
Yeah.
So that was a question I've always wondered about, because you're taking resources from areas and you see it all the time, to just transporting from one community into a hospital, and they get their staff on board. It's just they're taking away the vital service, what's needed most. There's got to be a way around. So, no, I appreciate that. But that's all I got for now, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Parsons?
Thank you. Question I have, it's a concern that's been brought forward to me by a constituent who is a paramedic in the District of Harper's Port of Grave, working for a private or community-based ambulance. And the concern brought forward is that, you know, I guess there's a difference in the overtime pay and, I guess, the training. I mean, what is, I guess, this level of standard versus the public-private? I mean, you know, are they paid relatively the same wages? Mm-hmm. Do they receive the same OT?
Yeah. And Wayne, I don't know if you want to respond to that.
There is a difference in how various services compensate their employees. And essentially, it comes down to the contractor and the company that they work for. We say you have to have ambulances available, but how they compensate their employees, they are a contract company that we move forward with. The challenge that many of them face is there's a significant difference. I mean, everyone in the province deserves ambulance response, but we have operators that will do many calls in the run of a day, and we have many operators who do very few calls in the run of a week. So to be able to, you know, match staffing and employee compensation is a challenge that the operators have. But that is essentially, you know, they are contractors.
Okay, and with regard to response times, and a recommendation from the last report at 2016 with electronic data gathering technology, which is yet to be determined, where are we to on that? I mean, have these devices been placed in the public vehicles where they can be, I guess, monitored with regard to response times?
And we're now tracking that that information, and we intend to use that then when we want to develop, you know, more in terms of response times, but really is from a quality point of view, are they responding on time, who's on the vehicle, because we are paying, you know, for each element. And then we'll use that information now when we sit down and renegotiate the contracts with the operators beginning this fall.
And this would apply to, obviously, community-based,
yes,
private-owned as well. Okay, just one last question for me. More like a question. There was an incident, as we can recall back several years ago, where a patient was being transported and had managed to escape on the Trans-Canada Highway and unfortunately was hit by an oncoming vehicle. Mm-hmm. And it was a fatality. What have we done as a result of that incident, you know, I guess, to prevent these further incidents? And this, to my understanding, was a patient with mental health issues. Mm. What has been done since then?
No, I'm not familiar with the case, Wayne. Do you?
There has been a fair bit of conversation with the paramedicine experts and the mental health staff on the transport of patients, you know, who are under consideration for that. We try where we can not to move them at night, as we do, and we try and take all precautions that we can, but it's also very much, you know, within the Act and within everything else, you know, what are the considerations for the patient themselves? You know, in the evaluation that's done, it's been a challenge.
And as a result of incidents like this one, I guess ambulance, paramedics and whatnot, and even and operators, do they have like a sort of like kind of specialty training when dealing with patients with mental health? Because as we know, a lot of these calls are to do with mental health issues and crisis.
But to your point, as this becomes more prevalent, that we have to ensure that, so we are, you know, we'll be building that in, as we're doing now with dealing with naloxone and things like, you know, so all of these. So as these issues emerge, we're sitting down with the Eastern Health, with the provincial medical oversight for the ambulance service to develop protocols, and then work with the operators and their staff to put those in place. But it does require the cooperation of each of the operators. So we have you know, outside of the hospital-based system, they're all privately or community-owned,
right,
and we have to engage each of those and get them on site.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. Okay. Ms. Rogers?
Thank you. So the Fitch report now is 4 years old, and that report called for complete overhaul of our province's ambulance system, and looking at, to when we looked at the three issues of a single agency to administer and oversee the program, a central dispatch system, a self-regulation of ambulance professionals. Is it fair to say that a number of the Auditor General's deficiencies that he found are because the review's recommendations haven't been followed through?
I wouldn't put it the way you phrased it
there. Sure.
But I think what they are reinforcing those findings, and that we now have in front of the minister a series of recommendations to, in fact, start implementing the Fitch report, which, again, are consistent with the Auditor General's findings and his recommendations, and how you now basically modernize our ambulance services going forward.
So, but again, you know, those recommendations are 4 years old,
yeah,
and still are so very relevant because we haven't followed through on those.
No,
why haven't we?
No, I wouldn't. Now, and I want to be careful. So, there different aspects,
yes,
are being implemented.
Fair enough. Yes.
But the larger system-wide ones, and I would say, because of timing of elections and government change and those things, it's probably slowed down the progress. Because I know the previous, you know, the department was on this road and had to sort of just, you know, sort of wait until the government was able to address it with it, the other priorities it's dealing with. But as I said, now the minister has a serious recommendations that he will be dealing with going forward. And we've spent a fair bit of time with briefing him and working with him on these issues. So we think, and we've talked to the operators. Again, there's a lot of change here. So as much as we would like to say, let's have it done by X date, there's going to be a fair bit of negotiation with them. And it requires an infusion of dollars. And given the government's overall fiscal situation, we've had to do some, some trade-off of dollars to find the money to put into this service.
So, is there any kind of guesstimate time frame around a central dispatch system?
Well, as the government has already committed in the way forward, that this is a priority and that we have to have proposals and out in literally in the next couple of months and ideally this year to have that that in place. So that's sort of the time frame we're working on.
So the proposals, like the request for proposals, will be going out in a few months?
Yes.
Okay. So there was a RFP that went out September 2015. And called for a design and implementation plan. And the closing date was October 2015. We're going to see this happening again.
That's different, right? That was the hard consultant. That was the hard bench. It was all work at CFDC, not to get somebody to.
But they didn't do that, though, did they?
They did that.
Yeah, okay. All right. Mr. Rogers, just asking Denise here.
Yep.
So that proposal that you referred to
was,
again, before I joined the department.
Yes.
But that was to hire a consultant to help us design.
That's right.
Which they have done. They have submitted a report. Now we are taking the ideas presented there, and that will allow us now, assuming government agrees, to go out with a request for proposals to put a central dispatch system in the province.
Okay, so not just for a design again, but
no.
to actually
yes.
implement the design that was, and has I can't remember, has that design been made public, the report from that proposal?
One.
And will it be?
Yeah, I don't think there's any reason why we, but now it may be caught up in our cabinet process, but we will check on that.
Okay, and if it's available, can we have a copy of that?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. So that's encouraging. So that brings us one step further, closer. Then in response to the Auditor General's recommendations on patient care reports, the department noted the process would be much more efficient with the implementation of electronic patient care reporting. Can we get a sense of where that might be?
The electronic patient care reporting, which is essentially laptops in the ambulances, ties hand and glove to the Central Medical Dispatch Center. And Fitch, when they did their planning project, envisioned that electronic patient care reporting be as part of the Central Medical Dispatch Center.
Okay, so there's no point in having them if we don't have a central, right? Okay. A question once again about the RFP for the Central Medical Dispatch Center. So the RFP might go out this fall. When is the anticipated, then how long for the RFP, and then the actual implementation?
From that, you're probably talking 12 to 18 months. And again, depending which options we come with and who responds, there are those that are, and there are some, there's some dispatching going on, quote unquote, centralizing because we have some of our operators because they run multiple services and large services in the province. Then there's those outside who have provincial systems that they could literally parachute in here. So we'll measure all of that once we get the responses. And we'll be looking at that, obviously, which will be the most cost-effective to allow us to proceed.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. King?
Questions here. Rural areas are always a challenge, and I look at some cases which have been brought to my attention where the one name, because it's all through private contract, no viewers are the big name out our way, but you have a dispatcher getting called from home, and then he has to go get his buddy, which you drive past the house, which you need to stop to get his yep. compatriot there, and then you got to come back. Has there been much thought to providing central locations, say like Bonavista or some where they can stay, be dispatched from that location, and you get there a little quicker time?
Well, I think when we get to central dispatch and the yep. concept we have is then you start bringing all those issues out on the table.
Okay.
And you say if you want the most efficient system and the most timely response, then you have to do things like exactly as you're suggesting.
And that's some feedback I've actually got from some yep. paramedics yep. as well. Having a central location makes more sense for them because yep. you know they haven't got to make that stop for their buddy, go back and go from there. Yep. One other thing that came to my attention very early on and after I got elected was what's being taught. I believe the paramedic college is in Grand Falls or Lewis? Okay. I think it's a private college, but I'm not sure. What's being taught and what was being tested at the time? Because I think at the time we underwent new standardization, so we went by something that Ontario went through or tested on, and what the attendants found were what they were being taught at their college wasn't being the same thing that they're taught on their exam. So has that been taken care of or something okay. that you're aware of?
I'm going to ask Wayne.
It's key in college we're talking about
yeah,
in
I
Grand
so,
Falls.
Yeah.
And they've had, to the best of my knowledge, very good pass rates.
Yeah.
I know because I deal with them that they have made some modifications to their training program to help the students be better equipped to do what they consider to be better equipped to do the national exam.
Yeah.
But it's not technical medical skills. It was how the questions were being asked and being phrased.
Yeah, I believe that.
That I think
yeah.
the first time around they had some experience, you know, that the students were taken a little off guard, but Key in Tech has very good pass rates.
And that was the attendant that he passed his exams, but there was a little concern at the time because there was a bit of transition time. And usually when you don't hear anything afterwards, everything seems to work out. So, no, thank you for clarifying that question for me. It's something I've had in the back of my mind for a little time. But that's all the questions I have, but I want to thank you to the department for providing us such detailed answers and listening to our concerns and moving and seem to do a very good job over the last 2 years getting things from where they were to where they are today.
Thank you. Ms. Rogers, you have any further questions?
I'm fine. Again, thank you so very much for today. And John, you've been stellar in providing all that information for us, and thank you to all your staff. And you certainly do have a challenge ahead of you, and I feel we're probably all very much in good hands. And good luck, and thank you.
Mr. Finn?
I'm fine with questions that have been asked by other colleagues. Thank you.
Gentlemen?
As I think everybody's completed, and again, want to echo on behalf of all the committee, you know, all the key things that have been outlined. As the chair, I always get to have the last word and normally ask questions that may or not have been answered or not answered to our satisfaction. I had 18 questions noted, and all have been answered to my satisfaction in even more detail than I would have thought. I do have one question that I'll ask Wayne. Can you give me a little bit of a breakdown, a rougher breakdown on the classifications from, you know, primary, secondary, ambulance services, just so we have an understanding of how that's determined?
You're talking about a primary and a secondary ambulance?
Yes, yeah, exactly, in a particular community or region.
John, do you?
Or John, would you?
Okay. What we've done is we have 83 ambulance bases in the province. Every multiple ambulance base has at least two ambulances that we contract 24/7 response. There are a number of single ambulance bases, and that ambulance base obviously is contracted 24/7. Other additional ambulances at that base, so say there was an operator who had four ambulances, two would be considered primary, and they are to staff them 24/7 with 10-minute response. The other ambulances are what we class as secondary ambulances. While they are still available for emergency response, their primary task is interfacility transport. And go from there.
Just the clarification I wanted. That was my understanding, but I wanted, you know, pure clarification as to where that is. So, other than any other questions, again, on behalf of the committee, I want to thank you guys. And, you know, it was a great opportunity for us to get some clarification. You know, we were impressed by the response that came back from the department, but there's always clarification. And sometimes you guys might use lingo from a bureaucratic point of view that us as mere politicians may not understand. It's good to get clarification because we need to keep our constituents informed. I want to thank the Auditor General and his staff also for being here. And we look forward to seeing the Auditor General again tomorrow. We have two more sets of hearings tomorrow. And you guys, right now, until we do a review in 2 or 3 years, you're off the hook. Anyway, thank you, guys. Thank the committee. And I want to thank Elizabeth, too. So we're good. Guys, tomorrow, 9 o'clock here, CYSF. Sorry? Oh, yeah. And while I got the committee here, we need to pass. You're good. You don't get to vote on these minutes. The minutes from our meeting of May 18th, which we reviewed which hearings we were going to hold. Moved by Mr. Bragg, second by Mr. Patton. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carried. Thank you.